Welcome to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast, a weekly conversation about mental health, personal development, and all the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. For more information or to find a therapist in your area, visit our website at therapyforblackgirls.com. While I hope you love listening to and learning from the podcast, it is not meant to be a substitute for a relationship with a licensed mental health professional. Hey, y'all. Thanks so much for joining me for session 319 of the Therapy for Black Girls podcast. We'll get right into our conversation after a word from our sponsors. Which friend are you in your sister circle? Are you the wallflower, the peacemaker, the firecracker, or the leader? Take the quiz at sisterhoodheals.com/quiz to find out, and then make sure to grab your copy of Sisterhood Heals to find out more about how you can be a better friend and how your circle can do a better job of supporting you. Order yours today at sisterhoodheals.com. Last week, we started a very important conversation to help with demystifying what we know about menopause. Joining me for part two of this conversation is Dr. Chrissy Freeman. Dr. Freeman is a second-year OBGYN resident physician currently working in California. Throughout her education and training, she has demonstrated a passion and dedication to advancing reproductive health and ensuring equitable care in underserved communities. In addition to serving her community, Dr. Freeman utilizes social media to document the highs and lows of her journey through medicine and hopes to dedicate her career to improving Black maternal health outcomes as a high-risk obstetric specialist. In our conversation, Dr. Freeman and I explore common misconceptions created around menopause, how menopausal symptoms can show up differently for Black women, and what health risks menopausal individuals should be looking out for. Please note that the information Dr. Freeman provided in this conversation is not to be considered medical advice, and any opinions shared are hers and do not reflect those of her employer or institution. If something resonates with you while enjoying our conversation, please share it with us on social media using the hashtag TBGInSession. Or join us over in the Sister Circle to talk more about the episode. You can join us at community.therapyforblackgirls.com. Here's our conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Freeman.
Thank you for having me.
Very excited to hear from you. So I want to start with having you try to break it all the way down for us because we are digging into all things menopause today. So what is menopause and who does it impact?
Yeah, you know, this is such an important conversation as menopause is something that will eventually affect anyone with functioning ovaries, which is half of the world's population. And so we define menopause as the cessation or lack of menstrual periods for 12 months. And this signifies the end of ovulatory function of the ovaries, so the ability to release an egg every month. And because the function of the ovaries is starting to decline, this results in lower estrogen levels throughout the body, which gives a lot of the common symptoms of menopause that we hear about.
Got it. And so is estrogen the only player in all of these symptoms that we hear? Because I think we'll get into this, but there are like so many collections of symptoms. And so are all of these things directly connected to estrogen?
Most of them, yes. There are multiple different hormones that play a role in the menstrual cycle and regulation of that. But most of the symptoms that women experience are primarily due to lower estrogen levels.
Got it. Okay. So can you go into some of these symptoms and side effects that we experience as a part of menopause?
Absolutely. So some of these symptoms happen even before the final menstrual period. So anywhere from 1 to 4 years before that very last period, women may start to notice these symptoms. So some of those could be irregular periods. So variation in how long periods normally last. If it was 4 days before, and now maybe it's 7. And changes in the quantity of bleeding. So some patients will say, oh, I'm having more bleeding than I used to, or actually my periods are super light when they were heavier. Women may also notice that the time interval in between their periods is changing. So for some women, it gets longer where there's months in between periods. Or for some people, it gets shorter where they're like, oh, I've had two periods in this 1 month. What's going on? Another big one is what we call vasomotor symptoms. So hot flashes, night sweats, which are very, very common. And over 80% of people going through perimenopause and menopause will experience these hot flashes or night sweats at some point. And this is that sudden sensation of heat in the chest and in the face that progresses to the entire body. Some patients experience palpitations, like heart beating fast, sweating, chills, anxiety. And this is because the lack of estrogen in the body is actually causing changes in how your body regulates temperature. A couple other ones are changes in sleep patterns and sleep disturbances. And so hot flashes are really common at nighttime. And so that can definitely disrupt sleep for patients. And then one that I think is really important that a lot of people don't talk about is actually mood changes and depression. And so for women who have a history of mental health disorders or mood disorders, going through menopause can actually make those worse, or even for some people, make those manifest for the first time.
Wow. Thank you so much for that, Dr. Freeman. You know, I feel like this is probably really difficult to tease out because so much of what you shared as symptoms could be connected to like all kinds of things, right? And you mentioned that sometimes even between 1 and 4 years before we actively say it's menopause, somebody might be experiencing these symptoms. So at what point would you talk with your healthcare provider about what you're experiencing? Like, how might you even connect some of these symptoms to possible menopause or premenopause, right, is another thing that is talked about.
Yeah, I think as soon as someone notices changes in their body or their periods, I think that's always a good time to start a conversation, just so that your healthcare provider knows what's going on and can keep track of things over time. I have some patients who actually keep a log or diary of their symptoms so that we can come up with a plan. So for some patients, they may have symptoms only at nighttime, and so that's what's most bothersome to them. Some patients have symptoms all the time, and so we're able to tease those out and come up with a treatment plan that works for different people. I think it's important to have these conversations, even if you're not sure, because it's important to know what's normal and what's abnormal as your body is going through these changes. Like we just talked about all of those symptoms, but some of those symptoms overlap with other conditions, like you just mentioned. And so it's important to start to have those conversations with your healthcare provider so that if this is menopause, we can normalize that, we can work through that, we can treat it. But if this is something else, we also need to be addressing that. And one of the things that comes up for me when thinking about having these conversations with patients and knowing what's normal is that if a patient hasn't had a period for several months at a time, especially if they've hit that 12-month mark and bleeding returns, that's actually a very worrisome sign, and that's typically not normal. And so you should absolutely go to the doctor, seek medical advice if something like that happens, because bleeding after menopause is rarely ever normal. And there can be many explanations for postmenopausal bleeding, but the biggest concern is actually for uterine cancer, which is the most common gynecologic cancer and one of the most common cancers in women overall. And so this matters, right? This is the Therapy for Black Girls podcast. So why is postmenopausal bleeding so important, especially for Black women? And the reason is that Black women are more likely to be diagnosed with uterine cancer at advanced stages and are more likely to have aggressive forms of uterine cancer. And so it's important to make sure you have a good relationship with a healthcare provider so that you can know, okay, this is normal. This is falling outside of the realm of normal. Do we need to take more steps? Do we need to do more workup so that, you know, we can try to combat these health disparities that we see in our population all the time?
Thank you for sharing that, Dr. Freeman. I was not aware of that. Are there other signs of uterine cancer that you think the community should be aware of?
Absolutely. Some patients may have like pelvic pain or pelvic pressure. Some patients might even like feel a mass in their lower abdomen, something that's new that wasn't there before. Any abnormal vaginal discharge or abnormal bleeding should always be investigated. Sometimes if patients present and share that they, you know, have had postmenopausal bleeding, sometimes we'll start with an ultrasound to just take a look at the uterus, take a look at the ovaries, all the pelvic organs to make sure, you know, everything is normal. Sometimes we'll actually just jump to a biopsy, which is taking a sample of some of the tissue inside the uterus to actually get a diagnosis and figure out exactly what's going on.
Got it. So, you know, so much of it feels like what happens with menopause, but I think in general, what happens with women's bodies is like shared in secrecy, right? Like we are kind of sharing behind closed doors. And, you know, it feels like some of that promotes a lot of misinformation. Can you talk about that as it relates to menopause and like how that sometimes prevents us from getting the correct information?
Absolutely. I remember growing up and watching all these TV shows and movies about young girls going through puberty and starting their periods for the first time. And it was always introduced as this narrative of, you're a woman now, or welcome to womanhood. And the concern that this brings up for me is that so much of our identities as women seem to be tied into our ability to menstruate, our ability to conceive. And so as women go through menopause and lose that natural ability, what does this mean for their identity, right? And so I think there's a lot of stigma surrounding these hormonal transitions that are completely normal and completely natural, but it puts pressure on women to redefine their identity, rediscover themselves when they've had such a significant change. And, you know, I think so much of women's health itself is focused on reproductive age women. We're comfortable talking about sexual health, contraception, periods, fertility, birth experiences, but there's not as much formal education and emphasis on menopause and the postmenopausal period. And that's not just for the general population, that's even for healthcare professionals. Not many of us learn about menopause, how to diagnose, how to treat, what treatment options are appropriate for different people. And so I think there's just a lack of information, which of course will always lead to misinformation or assumptions throughout this period.
What are some of the main misconceptions you feel like you've heard or that you have to combat in your own office around menopause?
I think one of the biggest ones is that, like I mentioned, that bleeding after menopause is okay. I remember having a patient who came in and was actually diagnosed with pretty bad uterine cancer. And she was like, I was going to the doctor multiple times and he told me since I had a history of fibroids that this bleeding was okay and it was probably because of my fibroids. And given that fibroids are so common in Black women, I wonder how many women are actually hearing this narrative that, oh, you have fibroids, so that's going to make you bleed in menopause. When fibroids are hormonally responsive, they're responsive to estrogen. And so if estrogen levels are lower after menopause, fibroids shouldn't be causing bleeding. Another thing is just thinking about the mood changes that come along with menopause. And some patients are like, I've never been depressed before. Why am I feeling sad? Why am I crying? Why are all these different changes happening? And, you know, I think it's just really important to normalize the very broad range of experiences that people have, the broad range of severity of different symptoms, so that, you know, there can just be a common understanding about the changes that are going on in women's bodies.
You know, I'm curious because you mentioned so much of the identity that a lot of your patients have is connected to this whole idea of menstruation and conceiving and fertility and all those things. And then once menopause hits, then there is a different conversation around, well, who am I? Mm-hmm. Can you share a little bit about maybe some of the themes that have come up with your patients or different kinds of conversations you have with them around identity and how that changes?
Absolutely. I feel like I've talked to patients where, let's say, for example, a patient is having postmenopausal bleeding and we're having these conversations about the possibilities and what if this, what if that. I think so many women hold on to the idea of maintaining their uterus, for example, because that is how they carried their children. That is what gave them this identity that goes along with menstruation and conception and all the things we're talking about. And so I think when we get into concerns with bleeding, concerns with menopause, changes in the body, I think it's very hard sometimes to have these conversations about whether hysterectomy is recommended, how to manage these different conditions. You know, sometimes we even offer add back hormone therapy for some patients, and just getting patients to come to terms with the fact that this is a natural experience that can be uncomfortable, that can be very disturbing and impacting people's quality of life, but that it's something that we can help with. And it doesn't have to consume so much of your life and so much of your identity as having this huge change and this drastic difference in the way that you perceive and relate to your own self as a woman.
For those who aren't familiar, Dr. Freeman, can you say what a hysterectomy is and when it might be appropriate for a patient?
Yeah, so a hysterectomy is the removal of the uterus, sometimes the cervix. So there's different types. Some people have total hysterectomies, which removes the uterus, the cervix, the fallopian tubes. Some people also have their ovaries removed. Some people leave the cervix in place. So there's different varieties, but there's various reasons that hysterectomies can be recommended. For some patients who are done with their reproductive years and they're having concerns about heavy bleeding from fibroids, for example, that's a very common reason that hysterectomies are performed. And then when we're thinking about the menopausal transition, postmenopausal bleeding, if there's any concern for developing uterine cancer, depending on what stage or how significant the concern is, there could also be a recommendation to have the uterus removed at that time for complete staging and diagnosis of whatever concern there is.
So can you talk a little bit about the treatments? Dr. Freeman, you mentioned briefly, are you treating like a collection of these symptoms? Is there some medication that kind of treats multiple symptoms? What does treatment typically look like?
Yeah, so treatment varies from person to person, depending on what they're experiencing and how bad things are. And so we can kind of go symptom by symptom. So for the hot flashes or the vasomotor symptoms, some patients try behavior modifications, like carrying a fan with them, wearing multiple layers of clothes, things that can be taken off to cool off, avoiding spicy foods or other triggers for hot flashes. There are also medications that can be used. So antidepressants, some anti-seizure medications, various different medications that can be used to treat these hot flashes. We know that antidepressants are actually one of the most effective treatments for hot flashes. And that also doubles if a person is experiencing mood symptoms or depressive symptoms. So that can treat both. Another very common symptom that we haven't mentioned yet is actually vaginal symptoms. So it's called genitourinary syndrome of menopause or vulvovaginal atrophy. Lots of big words. But a lot of patients, because of the lack of estrogen, may experience vaginal dryness. Patients have described it as like a sandpaper feeling to the vagina where the tissue gets very thin. And a lot of patients try over-the-counter things for this. So things that you might have in your kitchen, like olive oil, coconut oil, those can be great lubricants for the vagina. There are also different over-the-counter brands that are sold, but there's also estrogen creams that can be used to treat vaginal dryness. And the most effective treatment for all of these things, for any of the symptoms of menopause, is actual hormone replacement, which has been controversial over the past several years. There's always risks and benefits to anything that we do in medicine. And so I think if a patient is considering hormone replacement, they definitely need to have a conversation with their physician about what other medical conditions they have, because there are some medical conditions that make hormone replacement a little more risky, such as having pre-existing heart disease, history of stroke, history of certain types of cancers, history of blood clots. These are reasons that we might not recommend hormone replacement therapy for a patient. And there's also some thought about how long a patient has been going through menopause. If a patient is past a certain point, so they've been 10 plus years past their last menstrual period, that can also make it higher risk for using hormone replacement. It's very nuanced, right? There's no one size fits all. There's no one treatment fits all. Everything is variable based on the person, based on what symptoms they're experiencing, how bad those symptoms are, when those symptoms are happening. Just everybody's different. And so it's always an opportunity to kind of have that conversation, make sure you're keeping that journal or that diary so that we can address your concerns and make sure we're meeting your needs to improve your quality of life.
More from our conversation after the break. Dr. Freeman, can you say more about what hormone replacement therapy is and why it has been controversial?
Yeah, for sure. Hormone replacement therapy is actually giving your body back the hormones that are not being regulated because the ovaries have shut down their function. And the main two hormones are estrogen and progesterone. Estrogen being the primary driver, because as we've talked about, estrogen is the main influence for a lot of these symptoms that women experience. The reason we use progesterone for some patients is that progesterone protects the uterus. And so if a patient still has their uterus, it's important that we give progesterone to keep the inside lining of the uterus quiet so that it doesn't overgrow and doesn't turn into something more concerning like precancer or cancer. And so for patients who actually don't have their uterus anymore, they can have estrogen only. And these hormone replacements can be done in multiple different ways. There are pill forms, there's local forms. So like I was mentioning, the estrogen cream for the vagina, that's something that goes directly into the vagina and there's not very much systemic absorption, so it doesn't go through the rest of the body, versus pill forms or estrogen patches are very common. And so there's different doses of these medications, there's different ways of taking them. And depending on one's symptoms, if it's global symptoms, like I'm having the hot flashes, I'm having dryness, I'm having all the things, maybe a patient wants to do more systemic therapy, things that are going through the whole body to hit multiple systems. Versus if a patient is like, my hot flashes aren't that bad, but I'm really bothered by my vaginal symptoms, then we can do something more local, like vaginal estrogen cream.
I was surprised to hear you say that antidepressants are one of the kind of gold standard in some ways treatments for the hot flashes. Why is that?
You know, it's a really good question. There is some belief that the lack of estrogen alters the serotonin levels in the body. And so a specific class of antidepressants called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, those are one of the most effective treatments. And so for some patients, that's something that, you know, we can easily start and try. We can start at low doses and up titrate or increase the dose as needed to target symptoms. And like I mentioned, for some patients who are actually experiencing depressive symptoms or are having mood changes associated with their menopause transition, this can kill two birds with one stone.
Got it. Thank you for that. The other thing, though, we often hear with just working with clients who may be working with a psychiatrist or somebody with SSRIs is that then the downside is sometimes sexual side effects, right? So there may be loss of interest. I would imagine that you're trying to balance all of those things at the same time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's such a delicate balance because it's funny with medicine, right? Like you treat one thing and then it causes these other side effects that you then have to manage. So it's challenging. And I think that's why it's important for patients to not be discouraged, right? Like if you try one thing and it's not working for you, try something else. There's so many different options for managing these symptoms. And so, you know, I've had a patient who was like, okay, I want to try the SSRI first. But if that's not working, then can I try something different? Absolutely. There's no one size fits all. And there are so many ways to manage these symptoms.
So you've said that there needs to be like the absence of a cycle for 12 months before like menopause is officially declared. Mm-hmm. But do you see like a going back to feeling normal post-menopause, or is it like a new normal? Can you talk about like when we can expect to like, will you ever feel like your old self, so to speak, after menopause?
Yeah. So that's a really tough one because again, everybody's different. I feel like I keep saying it, but everybody's different. For some patients, these symptoms might persist for 5-10 years. For some patients, they actually don't have symptoms that are that bad. And so we see different trajectories for how people are experiencing their menopausal symptoms and what's actually happening to their body. And so there are some people who have really severe symptoms that persist for many years. There are some people who have mild symptoms that get a little bit worse, like at the peak of menopause when they're really reaching that 12-month mark, and then things get better. So that's why that kind of symptom diary is so important, so that we can keep track of exactly what a patient is experiencing and we can know how to titrate things. Like sometimes we can start to decrease medications. If we put a patient on medications to manage symptoms and now those symptoms are getting better, we can try to wean off of those. But for some patients, those symptoms do persist much longer than one would like.
So you mentioned the vaginal dryness that is sometimes a symptom, and I would imagine that impacts a client's sex life. Are there other kind of sexual things or sexual side effects or symptoms that women might experience either during menopause or in the postmenopausal process that you think people should know more about?
Yeah, I think just in general, decreased libido or decreased desire to even engage in sexual activity. And a question that I ask my patients when they tell me like, oh, I'm not sexually active, I'm not doing that anymore, is do you not have the desire to have sex, or is it painful and uncomfortable so then you don't want to do it? We can manage those things very differently. If it's painful and uncomfortable, maybe we just need to treat the vaginal symptoms. If you don't have the desire to have sex, is this a component of a more mood symptoms, depressive symptoms? What's the driver behind this, and how can we improve your experience there? And so that lack of estrogen in the body can really cause changes to the integrity of the vaginal tissue. Because of lack of estrogen, there's actually decreased blood flow to the vaginal and vulvar tissues, which results in decreased lubrication, which can then make things very uncomfortable. If a woman is experiencing all these changes in her body, how is that affecting her ability to relate to herself? How is that affecting her identity? How is that affecting how she wants to engage intimately with partners? This conversation is just so important to me because we need to start talking about these things, right? Like, I think there's such a huge role for women to be in community and to share their experiences, to normalize all of this. Because like I said, everybody's going to go through it at some point. But knowing that other women have dealt with this before and kind of having that community and people to talk to about how you manage this, oh, what did you try? What things worked for you? I think that's all really important.
You brought up a really good point, Dr. Freeman, in talking about, is it that you are no longer interested in sex, or is it that it is painful, or you have a different relationship to your body now, and so you don't think you want sex as much? Mm-hmm. Is there a point, and I feel like this is something that we hear often, and I don't know if this is actually true, so I'd love for you to kind of debunk this myth. Is there a point in our lives in which we can expect to no longer have a libido? Is it at some point that is like a certain age range where you're thinking like, oh yeah, like that is typical for people yeah. this age?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not sure I have an exact answer to it, but what I will say is that we see a wide range of patients. That's one thing that I love about OBGYN is we see patients from preteen years all the way through menopause and later stages of life. And I feel like we see a wide variety. There are some patients who might be earlier in the menopausal transition and are like, nope, I'm not interested in that. My libido has just really decreased. And there are some patients who are, you know, well into their transition and they still got it. They're still going. And so I'm not really sure exactly what the differences are and how some patients might continue to maintain that libido while other patients don't. But I will say that there is a wide range of people's experience with that.
So, Dr. Freeman, you know, the other thing I think is important to talk about is that it feels like there is also a group of people who will enter menopause maybe earlier than you might expect. Can you speak to that? Because what age would you expect to kind of maybe see people having some premenopausal symptoms? And at what point would you say, oh, they are experiencing early menopause?
Yeah. So the average age of menopause is about 51. And the perimenopausal period, so those changes in your periods, start of hot flashes or sleep changes, those things can happen as early as 4 years before the final menstrual period. So let's say your final menstrual period is age 51, you may start having these symptoms as early as 47, right? And then the ways that we define early menopause is really by age. So since we know that the average age is 51, we define early menopause as going through that transition between the ages of 40 and 45. And there are even some patients who have the shutdown of their ovaries, this menopausal transition, even less than 40. And that's, you know, a different condition called primary ovarian insufficiency, where the ovaries just aren't functioning. The eggs are depleted. And we see that that's not an uncommon condition. And so if you're experiencing these symptoms less than 40 or early 40s, again, bring this up with your healthcare provider, because that may be outside the realm of normal. And depending on when a patient is experiencing these symptoms, that may change what types of treatments they can be offered. So again, we try not to offer hormonal therapies 10 plus years after the final menstrual period, because that could increase a person's risk for stroke and cardiovascular disease and all these things that we worry about. And so I think, one, the sooner people talk about these symptoms, the sooner they can have a diagnosis and know whether this is within what's expected or not. But something that I've come across recently is just information about Black women's experiences with menopause. I was scrolling on Instagram and I saw a post that said Black women experience menopause earlier, they have worse symptoms, and they're less likely to seek treatment for those symptoms. I was like, well, I mean, I can understand this, right? Like, anecdotally, we know that Black people, especially in the United States, have worse health outcomes in so many different realms. And this is not because of our race itself, but it's because of racism and discrimination that has occurred in the healthcare industry as a whole. And that's a whole different topic that we can spend an hour talking about. But I was really curious whether this claim of Black women experiencing worse menopause symptoms is backed by evidence. And it turns out that it is. So there was a research study called the SWAN study, which stands for the Study of Women's Health Across the Nation. And it followed thousands of women in the U.S. of various ethnicities over several years, over 15 years, to kind of learn more about the menopausal transition and symptoms that people experience. And the Black women in this study actually experienced menopause 8.5 months earlier than white women. Black women were more likely to experience those vasomotor symptoms, so hot flashes and night sweats, and to experience those for a longer period of time. Black women were less likely to use hormone replacement therapy, and they were more likely to experience depressive symptoms. And so, you know, I think when we're talking about the menopausal transition, it's so important to center our community, right? Because we are having an entirely different experience when it comes to menopause. And so I'm so grateful that we're having this conversation so that women can know what to expect, what's normal, what's not normal. Is this too soon? Or am I still having bleeding and I'm in my late 50s, right? That's also abnormal. So that should be checked out.
More from our conversation after the break. Dr. Freeman, do you think that there is some connection, or have you seen any research that talks about a connection related to like the weathering impact and that being connected to maybe menopause starting earlier? What do you make of the idea that Black women will sometimes start menopause, at least in this study, earlier than the rest of the participants?
Yeah. So in the SWAN study, they didn't actually look at racism, discrimination, all those things as factors. But I think we can make assumptions. We can extrapolate based on this data. And so in various other aspects of health and healthcare, we know that weathering does play a role. We know that chronic exposure to racism and trauma throughout generations plays a role in how different conditions manifest in Black people. And so I think this is absolutely part of that same phenomenon. Black women experience racism constantly. There's lots of pressures on Black women, and especially the incidence of depressive symptoms being higher. I wonder how much of that relates to that chronic weathering and the pressures that society puts on women in general, but especially on Black women. That's something that we can't ignore, right? Like, these differences exist for a reason. And I think, unfortunately, in medicine and in research, there isn't always the attention paid to the differences that Black populations experience. And so often it's labeled as, oh, well, Black people have worse health outcomes. Black people have this, they have that. But why, right? I mean, I think that's exactly what you're speaking to. And I'm hopeful that as we try to increase representation of Black people in the field of medicine, that more of us will spend dedicated research time on these topics and trying to elucidate exactly what the influences are, exactly what those factors are that are contributing to the healthcare disparities that we do see in our community.
Thank you for that. So you mentioned that bleeding after 50 is also a concern, which I think some people might miss, right? Because you've already talked about like how this affirms people's identity. So this idea that you're still bleeding kind of feels like, oh, I haven't experienced that yet. Like I'm lucky kind of thing, right? Yeah. Can you talk more about like why bleeding after 50 might also still be a concern?
Yeah. Average age of menopause is 51. So that means some people experience it sooner, some people experience it later. But I think if you're well into your 50s, 55 plus, and you're still having regular bleeding, again, this is something to have a conversation about with your healthcare provider, especially if you have certain risk factors for something we talked about, which is uterine cancer. Now, I don't want to be morbid, but I feel like people need to know what to expect and need to know what these warning signs and risk factors are. And so for some women who deal with obesity, for example, the adipose tissue or the fat cells in the body actually produce their own estrogen. And so when the circulating estrogen levels in the body are higher, that can actually cause the tissue in the lining of the uterus or the endometrium to proliferate or grow more. And so as a person is having this thickened endometrium, they may have more bleeding. They may have continued bleeding for longer periods of time because there's abnormal growth happening there. And so obesity is one of the risk factors. Earlier age when you started your periods, or transitioning into menopause later. Like these are all risk factors for uterine cancer. Never having children is also a risk factor. There are some medications that are used to treat different cancers, to treat breast cancer, for example, that can contribute to uterine cancer. There are genetic syndromes where uterine cancer is more common. And so I think if you find yourself to be falling outside of that realm of normal, right, you're 55 plus, I'm using 55 as kind of an arbitrary age because it seems like that would be really beyond that average of 51, and you're still having bleeding, please just go get evaluated. I'm not saying that you do have cancer, but I think that's something that we really just want to be vigilant about because we know that, again, our outcomes with uterine cancer specifically are very poor and very, very sad, honestly.
So I would imagine, Dr. Freeman, that several people's eyebrows went up just like mine did when you mentioned never having children as a risk factor. Can you say more about why that is?
When patients are getting pregnant and having children, we know that that kind of changes the functioning of the uterus and the uterine lining. And so for patients who have never experienced childbirth, their uteruses just function completely differently. They've never had that kind of period of not having that proliferation. What we think about is what's called prolonged unopposed estrogen exposure, which means you're having estrogen but not having that progesterone to come back and quiet things down. Progesterone is really high when someone is pregnant. And so not having children just changes the way that your hormones have been affecting your uterus throughout your lifetime.
You know, Dr. Freeman, I have seen recently, it feels like people trying to use technology to maybe deal with some of the symptoms. So I'm sure you've seen like different wearables for people who have like hot flashes. And I don't know if they like give you the sensation of like cooling or something. Is there any technology or things that are coming down the pipeline that you are excited about or that you have seen be effective for any of your patients?
Yeah, something that is coming down the pipeline is a new medication that's actually non-hormonal to treat menopausal symptoms. It's going through trials and going through FDA approval now. But I think this could be a really big deal for patients who are high risk for hormonal therapy, where, you know, they have history of heart disease or history of stroke or some other condition where hormonal therapy isn't right for them. And maybe those other treatments weren't working. The SSRIs aren't working. The anti-seizure medications aren't working. There may be a new option. And I think that's huge because, again, there is so much stigma around hormone replacement concern for it precipitating cancer or causing you to have higher risk for cancer. And so a lot of women that I've seen are opposed to hormonal therapy. And so this just gives another option.
We'll be on the lookout for information related to that. So you've already mentioned a few things, but I'm wondering, is there anything else that you feel like is missing from the conversation as it relates to Black women in menopause?
I think the biggest one for me was the difference in the experience of Black women in menopause. And that not a lot of providers are educated about this. You know, I'm an OBGYN resident, and even in a lot of OBGYN residency programs, there's not formal education about menopause. I happen to be training at a place where people value this information and think it's important and want to make sure that we are as well versed as we can be and can take care of our patients as best as possible with whatever life experiences they're having. And so I think it's super important for one, providers to educate themselves, for patients to also educate themselves. I encourage patients to do their own research. I know there are some doctors who are like, don't Google anything. Google will tell you all the craziest things. But I want to know what you found on Google. I want to know what your auntie told you so that we can talk about it, right? Like, is this true? Is some of this myth? Is some of this old wives' tales? Or how much of this is, you know, actually fact that we need to pay attention to? Again, this is just such an important conversation, and I'm so grateful to you for having me here to talk about these things, because it's not common that we have these conversations in our community. You know, I even think about my mom and my aunts. I remember when I started OBGYN residency, my mom was constantly talking about her hot flashes. Oh my God, this is crazy. Like, I just got to deal with this. Like, what can I do? And at that point, I was empowered with this information, and I actually shared a lot with her, right? Oh, go ask your doctor about this. Have you thought about this? Are you having mood symptoms? Maybe these things could work for you. And so I'm very grateful for the education that I've received to be able to share this information, right? I don't know everything. I'm not an expert, but I think it's a great starting point to be able to have these conversations within our community.
Hmm. So there's a conversation online that I want to ask you to weigh in if you've heard anything about this. So there's a thought that Black women have always existed because you were an egg in your mother's womb who was an egg in her mother's womb. Is this real science, or is this kind of like a Black girl magic Afrofuturist kind of sentiment?
Yeah, so this actually is real science. So when a female fetus is forming, her reproductive organs are also forming. So her ovaries are forming. And when she's born, she has all of the eggs that she will ever need in her lifetime already in those ovaries. And so if you think about it, if your mom was in your grandmother, your mom's ovaries already had the eggs that would eventually get fertilized and become you. So yeah, that actually is real science.
Love that. Thank you for sharing that. So you've already talked about the importance of having more of these conversations, but what kind of future do you want to build regarding menopause awareness?
My ultimate goal is to be a high-risk obstetrics specialist. So menopause is one of the components of my training, and I hope that in the future, women can be more comfortable having these conversations, whether online, in churches, in the hair salon, whatever the case may be. I just envision a future where women are more educated about the changes that will happen in their bodies. They are empowered to speak up, to advocate for themselves, to say, this doesn't seem right. This doesn't seem normal. Is there something that can be done for this? Is there something that I could be thinking about differently to manage these symptoms? And so my ultimate goal for any patient that I come across and all patients in general is empowerment and just knowing that you have choices, you have options, you have a voice. And I'm hopeful that through all of our efforts to diversify the physician workforce, that we will have more physicians who listen to us, who take our symptoms seriously, who aren't dismissing us, and who can actually help us make sustainable changes to improve our quality of life.
Thank you for that, Dr. Freeman. So where can we stay updated with all the incredible things that you're doing? Do you have a website and any social media handles you'd like to share?
I am on social media. My Instagram is ChristyFree_MD. I'm also on Twitter. I like to share a lot about my journey through residency on my social media. For me, I am the first physician in my family. And so I'm figuring this whole process out as I go. And so I've been documenting my journey for other people to see, other people who don't have that example, so they can know what this experience is like. Residency is hard. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done. And my social media is where I find that community. There's so many residents, Black OBGYN residents that I'm in community with online and via Instagram. And that's how we remain connected and support each other. So anyone who's interested in medicine or just interested in what's a resident's life like, definitely check me out.
Absolutely. We'll be sure to include all of that in the show notes. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us today, Dr. Freeman. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad Dr. Freeman was able to share her expertise with us today. To learn more about her and her work, visit the show notes at therapyforblackgirls.com/session319. And don't forget to text two of your girls right now and encourage them to check out the episode. If you're looking for a therapist in your area, check out our therapist directory at therapyforblackgirls.com/directory. And if you want to continue digging into this topic or just be in community with other sisters, come on over and join us in the Sister Circle. It's our cozy corner of the internet designed just for Black women. You can join us at community.therapyforblackgirls.com. This episode was produced by Frida Lucas, Elise Ellis, and Zaria Taylor. Editing was done by Denison Bradford. Thank y'all so much for joining me again this week. I look forward to continuing this conversation with you all real soon. Take good care. Which friend are you in your sister circle? Are you the wallflower, the peacemaker, the firecracker, or the leader? Take the quiz at sisterhoodheals.com/quiz to find out, and then make sure to grab your copy of Sisterhood Heals to find out more about how you can be a better friend and how your circle can do a better job of supporting you. Order yours today at sisterhoodheals.com.